I'm Jenny Nevinson, and you are listening to the Minder Podcast.
Welcome to episode 28 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. Happy New Year to everyone. Hope you all had a great festive time, but now it's back to work. In this episode, we ease back in lightly with an interview with Dennis Waterman I came across recently, which I had never seen in full before. It was given in 2000 in order to promote his book Reminder. You will most likely have heard our earlier episodes relating to Dennis, specifically episode 14, which was a lifetime tribute, and episode 22, where we revisited the Reminder book itself and the Minder chapter. You don't have to have heard those episodes to enjoy this interview, but I do recommend it as they do go well together, which is why I'm publishing this. It is also one of the better and more in-depth interviews with Dennis. Most other interviews are either shorter or he was less interested in opening up. Here, perhaps surprisingly, it seems like he and Vanessa Feltz actually get on okay, and this leads to typical honesty, along with her interesting responses. It's a very enjoyable conversation and does connect with aspects of Dennis's life I have mentioned earlier, particularly his love life. There are some nice references to Minder, of course, so I'm sure you will find this worthwhile. The interview was originally televised on BBC One London at 14:50 on Wednesday, the 6th of December 2000. How's that for accuracy? I do love those old Radio Times listings. Before we continue, just a note to say stay tuned at the end of the show for two tributes to Minder contributors who recently passed. We also have listener emails and an update on likely future guests, including why Patrick Malahide might never appear on this show. For now, though, join us as we raise a toast for the new year to Dennis Waterman and indeed Vanessa Feltz. There's something I never thought I'd say. Here we go with episode 28 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org.
British actor Dennis Waterman's career has spanned more than 40 years. Although best loved for his roles in TV series The Sweeney and Minder, he's also an accomplished musical and stage actor who has starred in feature films. His personal life has been almost as action-packed as his on-screen characters, and Dennis talked to me candidly about his three marriages, his daughters, and life after Rula Lenska.
All right, are you? Good, because I'm all right. It's the others. Look, I'll tell you all about my problems, then we can all go around to your place and you can tell me all about yours.
But it all began for Dennis in 1948, when he was born, the youngest of nine, to a couple who couldn't stand the sight of each other.
My lasting memory of my parents was rowing. You know, that's all they happened to do. And then, obviously, they went to bed now and again. That was extraordinary. And especially me, I was like 6 years after the last one. So I was a big surprise for everybody.
But spoiled, weren't you, by all the sisters?
Well, spoiled, yes, in as far as there were so many people. Oh, yeah, I was spoiled to death, yeah, I was spoiled.
So we've got this atmosphere. There are nine kids running around, their parents rowing frantically. But in addition to all of that, there's a sort of theatricality about the place, sisters who dance and kind of...
Yeah, all of that. It came from my eldest sister, Joy, who ran her own amateur dramatic society, dragged us all in. But then they all went to... There was this thing in Clapham called Fay's Follies, which they all sang and danced in. So I don't know which side... And my mother played piano a bit and... You know, it was on East End knees up job, and but I don't really know where it all came from.
In 1959, while other children his age were still watching Andy Pandy and the Wooden Tops, Dennis was embarking on a professional acting career.
Back before six, remember?
I'll be home at 5:30.
I was going to take you now to 1959, where you start at the Corona Academy. Is it because you wanted to be an actor, or because your family fancied it?
I'd failed my 11 plus, so I couldn't go to the same grammar school. I don't know how I failed it, because I wasn't stupid or anything, but I just obviously didn't think it was that important. And then, at the same time, another one of my sisters met some people whose kids went to Corona, and she suggested that why don't I have a go at that? So I thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. And so I went along, and it was smashing. I really had a great time.
And within minutes, you were working professionally?
But actually, before I went there, in the summer holidays before I went, because they're your agent as well, so they send you to all these auditions, and I got this part in a film called Night Train to Inverness.
Can I have anything I like, Daddy?
Well, there are a menu if you want.
Trains always make me hungry.
Grapefruit? Mm. With lots of sugar?
Yeah, all the sugar you want.
And I played this little diabetic boy who was kidnapped by his father, who didn't know he was diabetic because he'd been in prison. And so this whole trip to Inverness was me going...
Terrible!
And then eventually their parents came together. Aww. For the sake of me, for the children.
You write about coming home late at night after work at the age of 11 and whatever, and being actually pretty terrified by the whole thing.
Well, yeah, that was The Music Man. I did a year in The Music Man, and which did me. I went to school in the daytime and then went straight to the theatre, and then came home on my own, you know, about 11 o'clock. And it was a long, leafy, black lane before I got to our flats. And some nights it was okay, and some nights it wasn't. But my sister. The next one up, Myrna, she said it was amazing because she knew how frightened I was because it was how loud I whistled.
But does any part of you, I mean, you're a father of two daughters, does any part of you think, what the heck were my parents thinking of letting me come back that late at night? I was only a kid.
It didn't occur to me then. I wasn't sort of... But in retrospect, I suppose, they weren't interested in any of it anyway. You know, they were quite pleased to come to the theatre and were hoping that I'd do well. My sisters were much more protective and worried, but... Well, not worried. I mean, it's just what you do at that age, or what I did.
What do you mean by being jabbed?
I couldn't help it, Sir Hugh. Honestly, someone did it to me.
Are you the wittest man in Chantry?
Yes, Cuthbert.
Don't look here.
Don't look at me. Take your eyes off the floor.
Why are you looking at the ceiling?
He's mad.
Are you mad, Wittering?
Yes, please, Trim.
There's no need to torment him. We must have discipline, sir.
It was very funny. You'd hear a load of sort of 12-year-olds on a bus. They go, "Are you working?" "No, I'm doing an audition for this and that." And talking like, I mean, the problem with us was we became 30-year-olds before we were 12. You know, "Oh, I've got a wonderful part in this thing." And I'm like, "You should be talking about football and stuff," which I was, of course. But no, it was a very funny life looking back on it. But at the time, it just all swept over me, and I had a great time.
Yeah, well, you had an amazing time because quite soon after that, you went off to Hollywood.
I did. I went to Hollywood, and I did the first hour-long comedy series ever made. I think they stopped them after that. It was about an English family and an American family, and they swapped daughters for a year. And the girl who played my sister was Judy Kahn, yeah. Who became famous in The Laughing and stuff, and she was. She was quite an active young girl. And one of her blokes was, who I think she married for a little while, was Burt Reynolds, who was then in Gunsmoke. So he used to invite me, and we used to go over there and play cowboys. I mean, it was a 14-year-old from Clapham, and like riding proper cowboy horses and being taught how to do all this stuff. It was wonderful.
And just going on display in shops now is another TV toy, the video cassette tape recorder.
In 1974, the year that saw the launch of the first VCRs and that classic 70s car, the Ford Capri, Dennis was becoming a household name as Carter in The Sweeney.
Dear me, Albert. You can shift for an economy size, can't you?
Leave me alone, Mr. Carter. I don't know nothing.
All right, you're under arrest. You told me enough to tie you in for conspiracy.
You can't do that to me.
Do you want
to
bet?
Was it obvious that the time at The Sweeney was one of the sort of all-time great classics, that you were in something that was really good and that you could enjoy being in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we knew we were doing something really quite special and very different for British television. There was no worry then, which I think was a help. There was no great panic about whether it was going to be a success, you know, in the ratings and all that. That's a relatively new thing, that they're all really battling for the ratings. But we just knew we had very good scripts, we had great directors, and we thought we weren't that shabby. And John and I were, you know, great mates, and it was it was just, I mean, it sounds horrible. It was just the joy to go to work every day.
Who taught you to drive? Evel Knievel?
Your career, as we know, started when you were 11. Was this the first time at which you felt the real kind of taste of fame?
No, I'd had it a little bit earlier. I did a film called Up the Junction, which was quite big, and the first time I really realised was we went to the premiere, which was at Clapham Junction. I wanted to go to Leicester Square. But it's very shocking. The first time it says, Up the Junction, starring Dennis Waterman. You went, blimey, it actually says star. I don't know what I expected. I hadn't read, you know, how the billing was going to go or anything. I just left that to my agent. But when it actually goes, this huge screen starring Dennis Waterman, you go, blimey, I've cracked it here, boys. But it didn't propel me into movie stardom, so as much as I thought it might.
Not long after his first marriage ended, Dennis met the actress Patricia Maynard, who was to become his second wife.
So you're with Pat Maynard, who sounds to me like a fantastic character and a great person from the book.
Absolutely, she's a wonderful lady. Yeah,
yeah,
and we're still very close.
And with her, you have two incredible daughters,
Hannah and Julia, who hate to think what she's going to become, because like she's been directing films, she's writing all the music for the shows. She's at university at the moment in Liverpool, so she finishes next March, I think.
And then there's Hannah currently in EastEnders doing a sterling job.
Very, very good.
Just hang on for one second and just listen to what I've got to say. I need your help.
Too late.
Look, I am serious. I'm in trouble. Big trouble. The housing association bill's gone down.
When are you going to realise? I don't care about your silly little deals. I don't care about you. All I care about is those kids, and you're making this a lot harder than it needs to be. Get off me!
1978 was a great year for Dennis. It was the same year that Boney M were top of the charts. Space invaders were taking Britain by storm, and Dennis was hard at work filming a brand new series, Minder.
It's 1978.
Oh, don't flare.
It doesn't it? And there's Minder. And this is a colossally big deal for you and for the whole of Britain, really, because everyone's hugely into it. There's nobody who would go, what? I've never heard of it, is there? Really?
I don't think so, no.
You should have seen him when he came out. He said, have there been any great technological advances while I've been away?
How long were you inside for, Arthur?
You can lock a man up, but you cannot imprison his spirit. It's up here. If you've got it up here, incarceration means nothing.
An hour and a half. He was banged up for an hour and a half.
George Cole wouldn't have been my first choice.
Why not?
Well, I just thought he was too posh and too soft, really, in a way. But then I found out he came from Tooting as well. He's a South London boy, but we, as he says in the book, in fact, that it, you know, we sparred for about 3 days of just getting, and then I don't know what clicked it, but we suddenly realised how similar our humour was, and we shared a dressing room, we shared a Winnebago, we shared everything. You know, this chemistry between actors is just an unbelievable stroke of luck, and George and I just absolutely loved working together. And we get the schedule and go, you're not on Wednesday. You're going to leave me here to work alone with all those strangers.
If you want to change your situation. In 1980, Minder also helped Dennis fulfil a rather surprising dream of having a number one hit. Just the wrong location.
Today, Arthur.
Spit in your face.
A year later, a glamorous redhead walked into Dennis's life. The only problem was Dennis was still married.
Would somebody please take these tapes?
Yes, give them to my assistant, will you? He's temporarily in charge.
No, I'm sorry, no, it's nothing to do with me.
So in 1981, the news breaks of your affair with Rula Lenska, and the press begin a sort of campaign against you. It really seems like that. They're really on your back day and night, aren't they?
It exacerbates the whole affair, if you want, you know, kind of backs you into a corner and you can't get out. You can't just say, oh, shut up, I'm just having a ding-dong with quite a good-looking actress. You're forced to make decisions which maybe you shouldn't have. And you get this stupid thing of being, you know, faithful to your mistress and not your wife, you know? It's called dumb. But no, the press aren't very helpful in that event at all. But nevertheless, we were called out, and I suppose, you know, you're in the public eye, so you deserve it to a certain extent. But it's not just you. If it was just you and the bird, then you can handle it, you know, whatever. But it isn't. It's a knock-on effect to everybody you know, your whole family, you know, your brothers and sisters, and especially the children, you know, they just kind of don't know whether you're telling the truth anymore.
You say the bird and you're reasonably kind of nonchalant about it, but it's quite clear there was something very special between you and Rula Lenska.
Yeah, there was. I mean, obviously, she was, I thought, a very, very attractive woman. And, you know, we were very, very attracted to each other. And when it was eventually all sorted out and we were living together and we started working together, we had just some fantastic times. And it, you know, in those days, you wouldn't think anything could possibly go wrong. I thought everything was just, like, as good as it could be.
Can you separate those two? Look at them. See? Go on, you.
Separate them?
Yeah. How do you feel about working together, Dennis?
What's going
you and Ruth. I'm here to ask personal questions.
You're not. You're playing silly games.
How do you feel about working
answer
together?
Answer the man. Go on, answer the man. We feel very good about it, actually. We did a tour. It was obviously dangerous, but please, I'm trying to talk.
Sorry.
We did
this all the time.
We
at
did
home.
This play in Australia, New Zealand.
Same time next year.
Yes. Yeah. And it, you know, you think, well, this is like a 24-hour commitment, and we really still quite liked each other at the end of it. So so far, it's so good.
How long was the honeymoon period? How long was it quite good fun?
Well, we had really a good sort of very good 10 years of getting on fine, you know, really, really very well.
So what went wrong?
I don't know, maybe neither of us had been in a relationship that long. The sort of insidious thing of, you know, the right, I've got him now, I'll change him. There was that went on a bit, which for a while I didn't mind, you know, it was... She was very, luckily, they're a very close family and a very nice family generally, but they insist on being together a lot, and that meant at my house most of the time, and you get a bit worn out. Then I kind of realised I was actually not involving my own family or my own friends. It was suddenly a whole, I'd gone somewhere else, you know, and I mean, I'm talking about friends who I've known for, you know, Robert Powell and guys like Paul Young, who I've known since I was 16, you know. Suddenly they weren't sort of being invited to the same parties and things.
And even your sister says, you know, we really didn't get asked much anymore. We didn't seem to be asked to play much part in their life. You must have known this was going on, didn't you?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, I'd say, look, next Christmas, we're going to do... I mean, the Christmases went on for months. I mean, they were a nightmare. And it's all Polish, so this is really good fun. And, you know, there's football on television on Boxing Day. Well, you can't watch that. Do you want to bet? No, you can't. Anyway. You know, obviously nothing. It's not all Rula's fault, obviously. But there was a very definite sort of change of whatever, life, really. And which kind of it happens so slowly that you don't know it's happening. And then you realise you haven't spent a Christmas with your own family, you know, for 7 years or something.
In your book, you're very kind of honest in terms of letting other people have their say, not something that many authors do. So people chip in all the time. You've got your previous wives saying how they felt at the time. You've got, you know, your manager and mates, in their own words, saying what they felt. And you've also got both your daughters saying how they felt. You know, they say, we felt, you know, very unhappy, very marginalised, or we really felt that no one was listening to us. But, you know, we didn't want Dad to be upset by
That's
it.
Right,
we didn't
yeah.
want to tell Dad.
Yeah, it's kind of it's pathetic, isn't it?
I mean, how do you feel now when you look at it? Because it's something
well,
that's quite devastating.
I feel useless that I didn't notice it. I mean, it was going on around me and I had no real idea, you know. Now, Rula really has got quite a lot to answer for with respect to my children. Especially with Julia and I, we had a very difficult time and it appears that Rula was really trying to turn her against me. For what reason, I can't imagine how that would benefit anybody. But... she's just such a power freak that she wants everybody on her side.
Are you getting in or not?
You've got a distinct knack of making an invitation sound like an order.
Look, Buster, I am cold, hungry and tired.
Stay Lucky, which Dennis starred in with Jan Francis, was filmed up in Yorkshire. Being 200 miles from home, it wasn't long before he ended up in the arms of another woman, this time Fiona Black, an assistant floor manager on the production.
Obviously, your marital record is a rocky, bumpy and pretty kind of roller coaster ride, isn't it? Do you think the whole time you were trying to replicate that feeling of having all those sisters making a fuss of you? Is that what it was?
I don't know quite. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that having that many sisters made it easier for me to get on with women. And you know, to the start, there was, some of them were a little older than me. I don't know what I was trying. I was trying to get a leg over, basically. That's.
But you were always succeeding. You weren't really trying, were you? It was just an absolute total 100% success rate with absolutely everyone, wasn't it?
Nearly.
Yeah.
I missed a couple, but...
Hardly any. But, I mean, it's kind of overlapping, interlocking marriages, affairs, marriages like that, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm actually quite embarrassed about having been married three times. I can't believe that somebody as sort of ordinary as me would have been married three times. I thought, when I got married the first time, that was it, that's what I'd do. But and that was kind of just too early for... I mean, we're very, very good friends still, but it was kind of too early for me to be married. You know, I was thrown in... As you say, it was Sweeney was on television every night. It was an absolute overnight success, and there were birds coming in from everywhere. It's what you're supposed to do, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you are supposed to when you're married to somebody else, though.
No,
that's the thing. You're not really supposed to, are you?
Yeah, but it's those, you know, these lame excuses about you actually didn't embark on something because you thought it was going to wreck your marriage. You embarked on it because it seemed like a really good idea at the time, and then it became an even better idea and all that sort of stuff.
1991 saw the outbreak of war in the Gulf. A newspaper tycoon, Robert Maxwell, drowned after falling from his luxury yacht. Dennis himself was barely keeping his head above water.
So we're forward in 1991 now, which is not a good year for you, because everything is falling apart. The stuff with Ruler's going really badly, you're having this affair with Fiona. You leave Ruler, you start really drinking like mad, and the drink driving. Come on, tell me about that year. It wasn't a good year. Don't tell me you can't remember any of it.
You know, I mean, it looks like I'm a big rebel rouser and I got done for drunk driving. Magistrates Court, next door, actually. But I actually, you know, I was never in the Oliver Reed sort of category at all. I mean, I didn't have any fights. There were the occasional photographer. But I was actually getting so much earache at home for various reasons. So in the end, I was staying out and drinking far too much, but I just didn't want to go home. So by the time I did go home, I wasn't a very pleasant person.
In 1991, you took a real loss on a film which you had, in an extremely gung-ho way, remortgaged your house to finance. It was called Cold Justice. And you said, ironically, you couldn't even stand the film at all. When it was finished, it was absolute tripe, you said.
Well, it wasn't too clever. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was very, very stupid then.
Why were you so stupid? You've been working all those years.
Well, because you're told by money men around you. And, yeah, I don't know. It was just real stupidity. But we were in the middle of filming it. We were in Chicago. We just needed this extra amount of money. And I was told that it was guaranteed never to really be used. But we needed it then. So, stupidly, I mortgaged some of my house, yeah. Lots of it, in fact.
The Cold Justice fiasco ended up costing Dennis £200,000, but luckily not his house. 18 months after their separation, he and Ruler decided to give it another go.
We had this big reconciliation. I was in Australia doing Jeffrey Bernard, He's Unwell. And I'd been in Perth and I'd been to Brisbane and then we were going to Sydney. And I phoned her from Sydney and said, look, this is stupid. Why don't you come over and see if we can work it out? So she said, yeah, it was all worked out. She got what time her flight was and all that stuff. And she arrived about midday after a 24-hour flight, which, so it's not good news anyway. And I sort of said, now, there are two ways we can look at this day. I said, either you can go to bed, or we go to bed, whatever, sort of now and get over your jet lag, or just rock on through the day and then sleep for as long as you can from this evening onwards. And she was like, quiz. I said, well, I don't understand why, and this was in the car, I'm driving her back from the airport. She said, I don't understand why I've got to make these sort of decisions. I said, well, basically, you see, England are playing Australia at the Sydney Cricket Ground, and we've been invited to a box, so we can either go sort of all day or we go this evening. She went, I've just arrived, this is reconciliation time, and you want me to go to a cricket? Because Poles aren't very fond of cricket. And it was a bit brave, I have to say, and probably very stupid, but we went, it was great, and we beat them. We beat the Australians.
Dennis, shame on you for that. How long is the flight to Australia?
24 hours.
Name one woman, Polish or otherwise, who'd want to get off a flight from Australia and go and watch cricket.
See, self, self, self.
In 1997, the world was rocked by the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, and supporters of British nanny Louise Woodward were campaigning for her release. Dennis was hitting rock bottom.
Which brings us on to 1997, a right stinker of a year.
Yeah, I think that's when Ruler left, yeah. And and I was in very bad state then. I was useless.
You didn't even look like yourself, did you?
Apparently not, no. I mean, you know, I was living on my own, which I'm not very good at. I've got some very good friends who were with me a lot, but no, apparently I looked terrible. I thought I was marvellously handsome. yeah, my skin was all horrible. Everything was peeling. I was just in a horrible state and very, very, very unhappy.
And work wasn't going brilliantly well at that stage.
No, the whole Ruler thing was one night I came back and I gave her a clump and I hit her and I gave her a black eye, which I was desperately ashamed of. And the whole deal, her deal was, if we go to do this in a divorce court, all this will have to come out. So I kind of went, oh, and I was so ashamed of it, I just didn't want anybody to know about it. And so I said, just take all my money, which she did quite happily. But then she went to the papers, and so it all came out anyway. So I would rather have gone to court, in fact, now. But it did have an effect. You know, they're going, this bloke is a drunk wife beater, and can we afford to employ him? And so I went through a very bad time professionally, and I had no money. Or very little.
And actually, your professional track record was completely impeccable. You hadn't ever been a drunk rabble rouser on set or anything like that and got into trouble.
No. So it was a very, very duff year, yeah. Mm.
And yet, that year, you still managed to meet the current love of your life, didn't you?
Pamela, yeah. She was part of the stage management at Windsor Theatre, where I was doing panto. And I'd done many pantos and I'd really got fed up with them, but this one was really good. They had a fantastic cast. And also, I was a bachelor. So, I mean, I'd done a lot of pantos with Ruler. So it was like between the matinee and the evening show, I was dragged round the shops, you know, which is fine. But this was really terrific. It was just 20 minutes away from my house and we had a wonderful cast and we had a really good time and crew, all the crew, and Pam was part of the crew. And, you know, it wasn't an instant thing. I mean, well, I suppose it was over 4 weeks or something, but we... you know, got to know each other a bit and then decided we should try and be together and have been sort of every day since, in fact. She's lovely.
And in rather a small way, without kind of mansions and houses in the south of France, and we started in a quite small, quite sort of...
I had to downgrade very swiftly, yeah. But I've managed it. I did it. I'm back.
No question about that, is there, that you're back? I mean, you're going to be at Drury Lane for a year.
Well, we start at the National. I'm doing Doolittle in My Fair Lady. We start at the National and then we go into Drury Lane, yeah.
So it's quite posh and pucker, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And some amazing names associated with the production. I mean,
Sir Trevor Nunn's directing it. Jonathan Pryce is playing Doolittle. Marty McCutcheon is playing my daughter. I'm miles too young for it, you understand, but I thought I'll just age up a bit.
If you look back on your life and you think, my God, if I'd had any idea how it was all going to turn out, what do you wish that you had known when you were 18?
I don't know, really. I haven't got any huge regrets, apart from, you know, I had a few years when I wasn't that good a father, but apart from that, or don't appear to be that good a father, apart from that, I haven't got any regrets. I went skint because of Ruler and now I'm back. I'm okay. I've got a really nice house, a lovely woman, two beautiful children.
So what do you fancy for the next 52 years, Dennis?
I don't think I've got 52 left.
I bet you've got at least 52 left, a minimum.
Well, I'd like to get my handicap down. I mean, that's a great thing about doing a year at the Drury Lane. I can play golf in the daytime. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm talking to Yorkshire about a television series. Another, you know, wonderful dream would be to take My Fair Lady to Broadway. I've never played Broadway, so that I'd like to do that and win the lottery.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Here and in America.
That'd be fantastic. So your ambitions are quite small, Fry, then?
Absolutely.
Nothing big. Dennis Waterman, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed listening to a great interview with Dennis Waterman, one of the best I've come across. As promised earlier in the show, it's time for a bit of a catch-up on listener emails and a few answers from me. Thanks to all those who've written into the show recently. There were many positive comments on the Looking for Mickey episode, which I appreciate as I know it was something a bit different. I should also incidentally have told everybody that I was going to take a month or two off before coming back in the new year. Did do that the year before, so I'm sure you worked that one out. It's probably going to be a regular thing, as it does take up a lot of time to do these episodes. Anyway, to listener emails. Jono, a regular correspondent, commented, "Really enjoyed this episode. It's amazing just how many parallels and similarities there are to the Krays and the other characters, even their names, etc. It's often said on various Minder forums that Freddie Baker is based on one of the Krays, and it seems even more likely after hearing all this. Although the Krays were vile people, their notoriety and legacy has always been fascinating and intriguing. My girlfriend's mum's cousin worked in The Blind Beggar in the 60s and knew all the characters of the East End, but she was not working on that night. I love episodes like this, which add an extra layer of enjoyment to Minder episodes. Great work, Paul." Well, thanks very much, Jono. Really appreciate that. And yes, I totally agree the Krays were obviously vile, but as you say, the notoriety and legacy has always been fascinating and intriguing. We still find ourselves interested 60 plus years on. Chris Grant also commented, "I wonder why they killed Mitchell after going to all the trouble of springing him. Maybe he was too psychotic even for the twins, but it doesn't make much sense to me. Never understood all the romanticising of the Krays and the great train robbers, although they did make for some great film and TV, like Villain, Robbery and of course Minder. The Looking for Mickey episode was darker than most, and one of the very few where Arthur gets roughed up, and was probably closer to the Minder envisaged by Leon Griffiths than the forced humour of the later ones. Perhaps the old school tie episode was also based on a true story." You could well be right, Chris. Any episode where the press are featured is possibly an indication that it referred to a real life story, something to look into at some point. The writer of the old school tie was Jeremy Burnham, who wrote just one of the Minder episode, one of the best. You lose some, you win some. Now, could this betting syndicate also have been a real-life story? And it's also funny, Chris, that you mentioned the great train robbers, because I do personally romanticise them just a little bit. But I did see something funny the other day from Alan Armstrong, of all people, commenting in a very good TV series from 1997, Underworld. And he says, I think it was him who commented anyway, it could have been Kevin McAnally, but anyway, one of them says that the great train robbers can't have been very good because they didn't get away with it, which is actually quite true if you think about it. But anyway, Lee Priest wrote to me and mentioned the Looking for Mickey episode also, saying, "I listened to your podcast Looking for Mickey and it was great. Another type of episode within the Minder podcast portfolio. One I very much approve of, and I'm sure if Leon Griffiths was around now, he would be happy to listen to. There's a thought. It comes back to the experiences and or research of the writers. Writers like Leon and Tony Hoare filtered their knowledge into the episodes, and it sounds like they blurred the line between television series and real life. As an aside, I vaguely remember reading that the pub which doubled as the Winchester in the early episodes of Minder was a real pub used by the real Arthurs and Terrys of this world. One can only imagine Leon and co. attending filming of one Minder episode and leaving filming with ideas for another story." Wow. Yes, I've heard that too. I think Jonathan from Minder.org would be the one to confirm that. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but it really would not surprise me. Mark Witherspoon emailed me to say, "Just discovered the Minder podcast and love it. I have binged all the episodes over the last couple of weeks. I've had a few messages like this recently, and it's a great boost to the work I'm doing to know that there are new people finding the show all the time. So many thanks to all of you who've let me know you're listening to the programme and enjoying it. Cheers, Mark." Several have said this should have been done years ago, and I couldn't agree more. That's from my perspective, at least. I don't mean, what a wonderful podcast, I love listening to it as well. I mean that I wish I could have done this sooner. For one thing, interviews might have been easier to put together. I can assure those of you who have requested certain guests that I am indeed putting things together behind the scenes and regularly research possible guests for the show. As you can imagine, it is quite difficult sometimes to find some of those who may have finished acting in the 90s, 80s or even 70s. Many are not with us anymore and few have an online presence. And then there are those who are still acting but may have gone on to other things or just do not want to talk about their appearance on Minder for one reason or another. In some cases, they may have done so many different TV things that they actually don't even remember. But here is a great example of the type of reply that can come my way. I thought a good potential guest might be Sharon Deuce, who appeared in Not a Bad Lad Dad, a very strong episode. I knew she was still acting. After contacting her agent, I received the following reply. Hi Paul, thank you for your email. I'm afraid Sharon doesn't have anything of note to say about this time, so probably wouldn't be the right guest for your podcast. Thank you for thinking of her. Best, Chloe. Now where do you go with something like that? Given Sharon was in a fair amount of 80s programmes, I can't imagine she does not have anything of note to say about that time. Maybe she just didn't like that era. Who knows? It is something I have come across recently, in fact, when rereading Brian Hawkins' book, The Phenomenon That Was Minder. And this one is for those of you who keep asking me to try Patrick Malahide, which is 80% of those who make a request. It's okay, I understand. I'd be wondering why he's not appeared on the show yet too. The answer is probably to be found in the Brian Hawkins book. When talking about Season 7, which was filmed several years after Season 6, Brian Hawkins reminds us that the viewing public had largely accepted that Minder's days were over. It came as a pleasant surprise, therefore, when a new Minder feature film was shown on Boxing Day 1988, 3 years after the most recent episode. And he goes on to talk about that, an officer and a car salesman. And then he writes, one of the most significant changes in the new season was that Euston Films had decided to drop the Chisholm character without explanation. A furore in the press ensued when word got out that Chisholm was no longer to appear. There was even a phone-in campaign organised by a national radio station, with the Euston Films switchboard being swamped with calls. They were eventually forced to concede that the character would return in the Christmas special, which he did, and named his own fee. In retrospect, it still seems an odd decision to axe a member of the team who was so hugely popular with the audience. Perhaps it was felt that the relationship between Arthur Daly and Chisholm was in some way upsetting the balance of the show. Whatever the reason, Chisholm's character appeared for the last time in An Officer and a Car Salesman as chief security officer in a private security firm, Chisholm having been forced to retire from the police force after an inquiry into his overzealous interest in Arthur's activities. Patrick Malahide said later, I was angry at the time, but kept it to myself and decided to leave with dignity. It turned out to be a blessing in disguise, as I was never trapped in the series and was able to move on to other things. Hawkins then lists some of the other things that Patrick Malahide had done at that point, and of course we now know him for many other things since, so he's only gone on to bigger and better things. He said, move on to other things. But I think the key phrase here is move on. Patrick Malahide moved on, away from Minder, who, by the sounds of it, hadn't treated him very well in his estimation, and that's probably why he doesn't want to talk about it. Of course, he did go to George Cole's funeral, and I think that he obviously had some respect and admiration for some of the actors he'd worked with, but as for talking about Minder and the wonderful episodes he was in, I don't think we'll see that. Before we go, I must mention the recent passing of two very special people. it was another Lee Priest email, which alerted me to the fact that the wonderful Andrew Payne passed away on January 12th this year. He was 74. As you might know if you've heard earlier episodes, I was fortunate enough to have an extended interview with Andrew in 2022. This came in two parts and was a real coup, as he was such a great writer for the show. Many other writers have passed away, several long before Andrew, but he was still going strong. I commented at the time how amazing he looked for his age, and he also told of looking after elderly parents, so the Payne family had very good genes. It was very upsetting to me also, because at the time I spoke with Andrew I was living in Cyprus. I actually wrote to Andrew a few times after the interviews, and he had agreed to meet with me once back in the UK. I would have met him when I ventured down to London, and suggested I take him to a Turkish Cypriot restaurant in honour of Minder and his work. So it just goes to show you, live your life like there is no tomorrow. Andrew was such a great writer and a very decent bloke who I'm very proud to have interviewed for this show. At the time of recording, I do not know the cause of death, but I extend my deepest sympathies to his family. The Minder podcast and the interview with Andrew was quoted in his obituary in The Guardian. I think he would have approved. A tribute episode will come later this year, but for now, if you would like to revisit Andrew's appearances on the show, go to episode 11 and 12. Last but definitely not least, I would just like to pay tribute to the wonderfully eccentric Georgina Hale, who passed away aged 80 on January 4th this year, in Luxor, Egypt, in fact. Had she played more of a role in Minder, it would have been nice to give her a complete tribute, but we will play this episode out with a worthy reminder of Georgina's contribution to the Minder Pantheon, as Renee, the Prozzy, in 1980s, the Beer Hunter. Rest in peace, Georgina Hale.
Bloody hell, I didn't, did I?
You weren't capable, dear. You barely tried. The flesh was weak and the spirit wasn't very willing.
How'd I get here?
Not on a snow-white charger, minicab. I have this arrangement with this friend of mine, Charles. Don't you remember Charles? He's only got one hand. Don't get many taxi fellows that have one hand. I thought his name might ring a bell.
Hellfire.
Don't worry, it's all intact. Apart from what you slip me of your own free will.
No offence, you have to watch your step, though, when you wake up with a prosy.
Oi, not so much of a prosy, if you don't mind.
You are a prosy. What are you if you're not a prosy?
I'm a part-time model.
What are you modelling? Bloody plasticine.
I'm not a professional one, any roads up. I'm only in it for my plant money. And I don't bother to do it when Erwin's away.
Erwin?
My husband.
The husband?
Is on container lorries, juggernauts. Is no Chris Christopherson, but I don't bother to ask him what he gets up to on a wet weekend in Bruges. Have you lost something?
Me kicks.
Your what?
Me strides, me bloody pants.
They're where you throw them when you fell in here last night, waving them around your head, singing. And like to get you on a slow boat.
Where'd I throw him?
Out the window.
He's a brainy bugger, is Arthur. He's got it all upstairs. The stunts he used to pull in the army, I'm not kidding. He's a crafty dog.
Ring him. He butch you in. Has he got a car?
Got a car? He's Arthur Daly. Arthur Daly's Jack the Lad. Have you ever heard of him?
Never.
How ignorant can you get? Are you sure you haven't got a can of light ale? Or a lager? I'm flaming gagging.
We've got more on our plates this morning than topping you up.
I hate this sort of evil, greasy, cheesy eye time look. Though it's garlic in it, I keep on getting the taste of it. Never heard of bloody Arthur Daly. Arthur bloody Daly. He's only one of the biggest car dealers this side of Watford. And you call yourself a Londoner?
I don't
don't call myself a Londoner. I come from Westcliff.
You stand me to come from Westcliff-on-Sea, lass, if you've never heard of Arthur Daly. Got a car? He's got more cars than British Leyland.
Get in. So get off his arse and come round here in one of them. He can run you back to your hotel and he can bring you round a pair of trousers.
I don't know where he lives.